From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Abigail Disney's father was Walt's nephew, Roy, who led a successful shareholder revolt in 2004. Roy was fed up with then-Disney chairman Michael Eisner's management, and Abigail helped him lead the charge. She still keeps close tabs on the company that bears her family's name, and she has lots to say about current management.
A little tiny part of me sees this as a little bit of an extension of my father's work, because I don't believe the company and the magic can survive this kind of corporate behavior. I don't think that the brand, as solid gold as it is, will last.
In the course of the pandemic, 32,000 Disney Parks workers have lost their jobs. Meanwhile, executive salaries were restored to pre-COVID levels in August. In this first of a two-part interview, Abigail Disney tells us where she thinks Disney has gone wrong. But first on the news banter, Hollywood may hate it, but at last you'll be able to watch brand new Warner's movies on Roku. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my colleague in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So Warner Media has taken on Hollywood, as we have discussed, and this is an ongoing battle over the decision to put the entire 2021 slate on the HBO Max streaming service. So they got into this battle that they are now fighting with the big agencies and the Directors Guild and so on and so on. However, they have won or somehow conceded to Roku, and their streaming service will be carried on Roku, which is a very big deal.
Yeah, I mean, that's about 40% of the market. And, you know, this is why they incurred the wrath of all of Hollywood, was to get a deal done with Roku. And the best way to do that was to put undeniable content on HBO Max so that Roku's hand would be forced. Wonder Woman is exactly that. The entire 2021 slate is exactly that. They got this deal done. Now we're going to be able to judge HBO Max as a success or failure based on the service and the content itself, not on carriage deals. And that's a very big deal. It also shows just how powerful Roku has become.
Well, I was going to say, you were like, they forced Roku's hand, but I'm reading about some pretty hardball tactics from Roku. And, you know, they're kind of like, we're going to shoot your puppy if you don't meet our terms. They want content for their Roku channel that they are going to get from some of the legacy companies. They want a share of ad revenue from HBO Max when they start charging. They have a different tier where it's going to be ad supported. And they are hardball players too. So I'm not sure who's zooming who here.
And I'm not sure we will ever know, but it really does show the power of Roku in 2020, because their stock is through the roof. They are now worth $42 billion, bigger than Viacom CBS. They have been the clear winner of this year of, you know, through the roof streaming. And they're the gatekeeper. That's what they've done. They have created this wall where they are the conduit between these media companies and the consumers. Every media company says, oh, we are direct to consumer now. They're actually not. They need this gatekeeper, and there are many different ones, but Roku has about 40%. You know, Amazon and Chromecast and Apple TV, they're all players, but Roku is the biggest. They've been able to extract the most.
I'm fascinated by this chief executive and founder, Anthony Wood, who I paid no attention to, I admit. He said in the Wall Street Journal, we're often underestimated by the industry, I'll say. But this is a guy, I really couldn't quite even believe what I was reading. According to this article, he invented the digital video recorder because he wanted to watch Star Trek episodes. He founded Replay TV. He then invented the streaming media player and founded Roku. I mean, who this guy...
And he worked at Netflix for a while, and Netflix was the first client. So that's not a bad horse to bet on.
So let me just pivot back to the Warner move. Jason Kilar, not only has he been through some bad press, some of which delivered by me, about, you know, upsetting Denzel Washington by putting his movie Little Things on the streaming service without any consultation. There's a Chinese company called Starlight that had paid for James Wan's next movie, Malignant, $60 million. And Warner doesn't own any of it. And apparently they are very much up in arms about this decision. And James Wan had an enormous piece of back end. So he, of course, does want a theatrical article component. That company could team up with Legendary, which is upset, as you know, Matt, about Godzilla versus Kong and about Dune. So there's all of that. And then there was a really interesting article about the situation at CNN where Jason Kyler is once again putting his imprint. He had sent a congratulatory memo to the staff there about their election coverage, and that didn't go. It was a strange and not great look.
Yeah. According to the New York Times reporting of this email, he congratulated CNN on being the first network to call Arizona for Joe Biden. And as most casual observers of the election know, it was Fox News that actually called the election in Arizona for Biden first.
Which has sparked enormous controversy. Yeah.
Which, you know, and Kyler is on Twitter all day talking to people, and he's kind of trying to be the, you know, the cool young CEO. And you think, like, you've got corporate communications executives, at least have them fact check your email to the entire company.
Yeah, the Times said there were multiple errors in the first couple of sentences. And then there's a huge question about the fate of Jeff Zucker at CNN, because it's just not clear that he is going to be happy with whatever Jason Kyler has in mind to create a streaming version of CNN or some kind of pay version. I'm not clear on what that is, but there's obviously a lot of tension there. And I gotta wonder, you know, does there come a point where AT&T gets nervous about all of this noise?
Yeah, Ben Smith of the New York Times suggested on one of their podcasts this past week that Kyler might be a sacrificial lamb and lose his job for the handling of this transition from theatrical over to streaming just because of the backlash in Hollywood and how everybody is up in arms. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if that's the case, not because AT&T is apologetic about what's happening and how they want to turn HBO Max into Netflix, but the way it's been handled and the unilateral decision and the lack of respect for some of the top creators, they're going to have to do something that shows they understand that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of speculation about who gets to be the sacrificial lamb. I will say, I can't imagine Kyler did this without the sign-on of John Stankey, the head of AT&T. But then again, people have choose not to remember things that didn't turn out well. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, former editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. Earlier this month, Disney held a dazzling 4-hour investor conference. The company announced more spin-offs and series for its Disney Plus streaming service than we have time to list. Fans rejoiced over upcoming Star Wars and Marvel movies. Disney shares hit an all-time high, and stockholders celebrated, too. Well, most of them. On Twitter, Abigail Disney had a different reaction. Her take was that share prices were divorced from what was happening to the company's workers. And she called that a complete moral breakdown of this entire system. The higher share prices go, she wrote, the more disgusted I get, even as they enrich me. As a Disney, Abigail is well aware that she has reaped tremendous financial rewards her entire life. But she's given much of her money away and has no qualms about calling Disney out when she believes it has gone astray. As the company that bears her family's name was forced to close its parks because of the pandemic, it laid off 28,000 workers, and another 4,000 will lose their jobs at the end of the year. Today, we're sharing the first of a two-part conversation with Abigail Disney. We'll air the rest, which focuses on her experience growing up as a Disney early in the new year. But this week, we start by talking about the man who shaped the company as it is today. Bob Iger has been running Disney since 2005. He officially stepped down as CEO in February, but remains as executive chairman. I'm not sure where you are on him right now and what you make of that sudden resignation as CEO. That was really not characteristic of Bob Iger. Like, normally it's all very presented and managed. And this was like, I'm jumping in front of the camera. Here's the new guy. I'm out. Except I'm not really out. Yeah. Like, I'm really baffled. Like, who are you in or out? I'm like, I can't tell.
There's no question it's baffling, and that there's probably something to know in the fact that it was baffling, because, like, he doesn't do things that way. So beyond that, I have no information, because believe you me, nobody in that C-suite is talking to me these days.
Really? I can't believe that.
Yeah, you know, and he left, but he didn't leave. But, you know, he was there and he's not. And, you know, I mean, part of me imagines maybe he looked at what was happening in China and knew what was coming for Disneyland and the parks, and thought, maybe I don't want to be presiding over that.
Yes. Plus, I think that the streamer was showing that it was going to, right. I mean, they're doing amazing, but at the time yeah. it was very like a big yeah. thing to manage, you know, it's a huge project.
You know, he was a great manager, and I have never stopped saying this. He's a nice man and a great manager. I have nothing personal against him, but his strategy from the day one was to buy Pixar, buy Lucasfilm, buy, you know, he was a purchaser of creativity, which added and added to the machine. And the machine is like this furnace, and you just feed the creative product in there, and it like spins out all this other stuff. And then you can add a hotel, and you can, you know, expand the park. You can do all this stuff. But if you don't keep feeding it creativity, mm-hmm. it's really, but there had to have been a point at which there was too much in the machine, or the machine was too complicated. And I kept wondering whether Fox was going to be that. Mm-hmm. So the streaming yes. turns out to be another part of the machine that gets fed. And so I think they're going to digest it better than I was expecting they would. But I do think that there was some of that. But I think there's a deeper layer to it that I will never know, and you will never know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because it was just too out of character.
Too out of character, yeah. And the Fox thing, yeah. I mean, it feels like they sort of swallowed it, but I'm not sure what they got that was worth that kind of money and that kind of debt yeah. load. And, yeah. you know, it's a
but that's what I said about Marvel. That's what I said about Lucasfilm. So I've been wrong every time. So I'm prepared to be wrong about this. I mean, the share price right now is, I don't understand it, but there it is.
The stock price, of course, is doing well because there's no trove of IP, like, you know, what they call IP, and I kind of hate that, but they call
yes,
it
intellectual. I know.
I hate it, but they call it that.
Yeah.
And there's no branded companies, you know, like Disney. So, and the streamer's doing great. So I get it.
Yeah.
However, you know, we're seeing feasting, and this is your issue, I think, among the management, among the well-compensated executives, an absolute literal famine among people who had worked for the company for years. There was that heartbreaking story about just one person who had been a waitress for 14 years.
14 years.
Completely going through the safety net, and, you know, these people becoming homeless. Horrifying stories. And I can imagine that is, I don't have to imagine, you've said how upsetting that is for you.
Yeah. And you know, people have approached me about our relief fund and all these kinds of things. And this is not about charity. This is not about charity. This is about the way we structure it. And I know that when I try to draw a direct line between how the C-suite is paid and how the hourly workers are paid, when I try to draw a direct line between those things, I think they look at me like I'm speaking in some kind of alien language, because to them, that's just the dumbest thing they've ever heard. There's no relationship between what we pay, you know, a line worker and a shift worker and what we pay Bob Iger. You know, he's the genius and the only person on earth who could accomplish what's been accomplished here, and therefore give him what he's asking for. You know, I actually was doing a little math this morning, and last year the bonuses amounted to almost $100 million for just the top named executives there.
Wow.
At the very top of the pile. And I know that when the letter went out about the layoffs, it included lines about how your end date is December 31st, but we're telling you this in the beginning of November. If you find a job between November 2nd and December 31st, you won't get your severance pay.
Wow. Yeah.
I mean, nickel and diming people. When if you took that $100 million and look at 32,000 laid off employees, you know, everybody could get a nice $3,000 plus check out of that. If you cut that in half, they'd get a $1,500 check out of it, you know, more than what the government is giving out. I mean, there's no reason on earth that justifies that. And part of the problem is that they keep claiming it's performance-based pay, but they don't include how their employees are doing in the idea of how they're performing as executives. And that is the real problem. There's a moral disconnect, and we just keep waving it through because this is what business schools tell us is how it's done. And I'm saying, like, just it's time to do it differently, and I don't care what the business school says. And, you know, people always are like, but they have to run a company, and you don't understand it. It's so complicated. And I'm like, well, no, some things are not complicated. You have costs and you have revenues, right? And if you can't, with these costs, get to the revenues you need to be at, then you go back and you move some stuff around. And the moving part that they always go for first is what compensation for the lowest people. And I say we just stop making that a moving part, because there's a certain level below which you cannot go in the name of human decency. You know, and it tends to come in a package. The high compensation at the top tends to go as a reward for pushing down on the compensation at the bottom. One reason, you know, Iger is being paid so handsomely is not just because of the share price, but because of the margins, right? Mm-hmm. Because he's been able to push the cost of running the parks down while also milking it for massive amounts of profit, historic profit. So he's a really good manager, like I say, but he's a good manager in the Milton Friedman sense. Maybe we'll change the avatar. A good manager in the Ebenezer Scrooge sense, and not in the sense of a person who sees everyone who works for him as a full human being with equal right to dignity.
That is a harsh thing, but and you mentioned that.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you see this more broadly, not as a Disney problem, emblematic of a problem in boardrooms and corporate cultures across this country, where the shareholder is God and the workers are cogs in the machine and that are highly dysfunctional and treated just the minimum that has to be given them. And, you know, this has been a huge conversation that doesn't seem to budge. It's so frustrating.
Well, yeah, because the forces that keep it from budging are the forces that are profiting by not letting it budge. So that's one of those situations that is just going to have to be broken somehow by outside forces. Legislation is going to have to be one of them. But one of the outside forces that pushed the whole business world in this direction was norms and culture. And I know that sounds like such a wobbly, non-concrete thing, and it is, and it's a hard thing to measure and track and point at. But it is clearly much of what's driving this. You know, my grandfather, you know, made a lot of money, and he provided for me, even provided for my children. Of course, you know, no, he wasn't shy about taking compensation. But two things were very different from him and a contemporary CEO. You know, Bob Iger spent his lifetime on a salary.
Right. He doesn't own.
Well, not just own, but risk. That's right. What I'm talking about.
Okay.
So not, I'm not talking about ownership. I'm talking about, are you willing to put everything you have in hock again and again and again and again, every single time with the chance of losing everything to keep this company going? Because that's what my grandfather did. And so if he came home with the big bucks, I would say he earned them.
Right.
And, you know, he would never have taken a $66 million payday, never, especially knowing what was happening at the low end for his employees. And not because he was a perfect guy, but it wasn't done. It just wasn't done. There was no law against it. People did not do that then.
And people had pensions and security when they worked for a company.
Exactly. And when I think about these people who are left now high and dry at 50, 55, and laid off from one of these parks after 14, 15 years. And during that time, they were paid barely enough to pay the rent. They don't own anything. They barely have enough food on the table. And then that's it. It's over. They get a little severance package because they were good and they didn't take another job. And now where are they going to go? People are starting to starve. So let's not pretend that they go somewhere and disappear. No, they go somewhere. They lose their houses. They're homeless. And they have to steal things to eat.
Do you get blowback from Disney because you articulate these ideas?
Not publicly, no.
Privately? I'm just curious, as far as you're willing to tell me, did somebody call you and say, what are you doing? You mind, you're not helping, and
yeah.
Your family or
you
stuff
know,
like that?
Actually, no, I've gotten nothing like that. No one has reached out to me directly at all, which I find strange, actually. A little tiny part of me, now I'm going to risk sounding like a megalomaniac, but a little tiny part of me sees this as a little bit of an extension of my father's work, because I don't believe the company and the magic can survive this kind of corporate behavior. I don't think that the brand, as solid gold as it is, will last. And I think it's the kind of brand that's so enormous and all-encompassing, and people invest so much into it, that I don't think it'll erode slowly. It will, you know, fall over like a great sequoia. And then what will that company be? I mean, what would you value those assets at if that brand dies? So, you know, I'm a little bit about saving the company over the long term. I mean, I think the company needs to be saved from itself.
Coming up after a short break, Abigail Disney issues a direct challenge to top Mouse House executives. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Abigail Disney, daughter of Walt's nephew, Roy Disney. Abigail is an outspoken critic of the company bearing her family's name, and she hosts a podcast called All Ears. Abigail Disney is enraged that so many workers at the Disney theme parks and elsewhere in the company have lost benefit after benefit, and that this year 32,000 of them lost their jobs. Meanwhile, the Disney Plus streaming service came roaring out of the gate and stock prices have hit record highs. But even before the pandemic, Abigail Disney expressed her belief that in recent years, Disney has faltered as a keeper of Walt's creative flame.
When you talk about when creative companies referred to the, you know, product or whatever as IP, it makes me sad too, right? Because something in the creative process is, it's like alchemy, right? That somebody Yes. comes along with a vision, no one else can do what they do. And what they do is extraordinary. And then to make that subservient to, and to treat it like just the salami at the deli, you lose something really important. And so creative companies will very often kind of crest and then die, because they get to be so successful business-wise that they can't figure out how to make that coexist well so that it doesn't kill the creativity. And, yes. and Disney has solved that problem by buying creativity, but they can't do that forever. And they need to figure out how to live with creativity and to venerate the creatives in a way more than they've been venerating up till now their executives.
Were you surprised to see Bob Chapek as the person taking over as CEO?
You could have knocked me over with a feather. I mean, it was disappointing, extremely disappointing to see that a person who'd never held a creative job in his life take the helm at that company. It just said, oh, well, okay, now the process is complete. It's just a business. It's just the deli. They're selling salami. And what they're going to have to do is slice it as thin as they can possibly slice it, because they're not making any more salami.
It's getting to be a big problem, I think, generally in this era of streaming and the digital mm-hmm. people coming in, that they don't grasp how creative people work.
In this business, there's this tension that is perpetual between the executives who are trained as business people to think about mitigating risk. Right. And right. then you have creatives, and all they do is risk. If without yes. risk, they can't function. And so, you know, you have to find executives of a special kind who can understand and respect what risk means and figure out a way to make it live inside of a profit-making company. And what you have is the victory of the executives in Disney.
So, you know, we do see, thank God, finally this vaccine, well, not finally, very quickly this vaccine mm-hmm. rolling out.
Yeah.
The parks potentially could reopen. It's been a big, mm-hmm. bitter fight, as you know, with Disney pushing Gavin yes. Newsom to open Disneyland and, you know, being very performative and open about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is an example of Disney openly yeah. leaning yeah. on a political person. I'm assuming you wouldn't necessarily think theme parks should have been open, but maybe that's not right.
No, I don't think the themes, especially now. So yeah, we've got a vaccine on the way, and that's great, but it's going to take months before it's really broadly enough distributed to, in fact, really mitigate risk. And the risk, let's not forget, was to their employees, but it was also to all the people who came from all these different places around the world and then went back to wherever they were coming from. So it was not just the risk of the employees, but also the risk of just continually seeding new colonies of infections. So I know that Florida has been open for a while, and everybody says non-eventfully so, but there have been reports that some, you know, cases among employees have been suppressed. I don't know that to be true. That was other reports. But, you know, Florida proved itself to be something of a show. So I don't know that Florida should have opened. And, you know, I'm sorry. This is a really horrible, horrible thing for a theme park, you know, to have to close like this. And,
yes.
you know, obviously revenues are getting destroyed. But just this morning in the paper, they're talking about how, well, the streaming services are going to lose $7-8 billion over the next few years, but then they're going to be incredibly profitable, and so their share prices go up. How is it that they have $7-8 billion in their pocket to invest in something mechanical and technical, but they don't have $1 billion to support their employees while they get back to the full operating size. Mm. Why are they shifting the burden of their employees, frankly, onto us, taxpayers? Because that's what they're doing. When they lay people off, and then they're going to go back and rehire, and they will weed out the ones that were problematic and weed out the ones that were old and weed out the ones who were senior when they start hiring people back, because that saves them all kinds of money and trouble. And in the meantime, what they've done is they've shifted the burden of people's hunger and people's housing and people's safety and health onto the taxpayer. So, you know, we're all willing to look at them lose money in the name of an eventual profit when we're losing the money on making films and finding subscribers, but we're not willing to lose that money on retaining employees and looking after their well-being.
Wow. Well, we have a Biden administration. Maybe there will be some changes. I don't know. We've seen the certainly Mitch McConnell in the GOP Senate trying to make sure nobody has to be liable for people who got sick. I don't know. Do we have any hope for tomorrow?
Well, let's not forget that Joe Biden was the senator from Delaware, where 90-some percent of American corporations are based, and that Bob Iger is a huge Democrat supporter and thought about running for president in the same party. So it's not like the Democrats are really looking at pushing back on corporations in a way that's meaningful.
So you're not holding your breath that the Biden administration is going to tackle this stuff?
They're not going to charge right out and start
Pressure from the left, you know, to do something.
There will be pressure, and the left has never really been very successful in applying pressure at the Democratic Party. But I will say where the pressure can come from is inside the business community, where there are people thinking differently about this. And, you know, there is such a thing as peer pressure. And I think that some of that could really make a difference. You know, they have to get some courage about calling each other out. They're not, right now, they're a little chicken about that. There's like this honor among thieves, or why sharks never eat other sharks kind of thing. But there are business executives who are starting to speak up about different ways to handle this. I would say, like right now, today, one thing Disney can do is take half of the C-suite bonuses from this year, half of them, and put them in a cast member relief program today. They could do that.
Have you figured out how much money that would be?
Well, if it's the 100 and it was last year, I don't see it going down much. I mean, the share prices are high. So that's what they live, eat, and breathe. So, you know, if it's around 100, they would put $50 million in a cast member relief fund and then make sure people are eating and living in houses and so forth. So, why wouldn't they do that? Why wouldn't they do that?
I don't know. Maybe they need more yachts or something.
Yeah. I personally challenge them to do it now.
That was filmmaker and philanthropist Abigail Disney. We'll have more from her, including some great stories about growing up with the Disney name, in the new year, following our annual Mega Banter next week. And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with help this week from Kat Yore. Paul Smith mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.